I'm Kurt Anderson. Today in Studio 360, an unusual take on family issues.
You don't know nothing about your father. You don't know nothing about your family.
What to do when your estranged dead father turns out to have been a god?
Back when he was a god, she told him. Back then, they called him Anansi.
Neil Gaiman's new novel, Anansi Boys, addresses that very problem. Neil Gaiman joins me to discuss the new book and his new film, Mirror Mask. It is about a teenage girl who doodles obsessively and then gets sucked into the world she's drawn.
Great! They can have my life! I want to run away and join real life!
I don't think you could handle real life, Helen.
All that, plus the Super Bowl, bouncing right back at you.
There must be a Super Bowl paradise or heaven where all the Super Bowls that we've lost go.
That's ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. You may know Neil Gaiman as the creator of Sandman, a comic book epic about a dysfunctional family of immortals. It has been called the best comic ever. Or maybe you know him as the fantasy novelist who in 2001 published his breakthrough bestseller American Gods and who has a brand new book out called Anansi Boys. Neil Gaiman is also the screenwriter of an intriguing new film, Mirror Mask, which is about a girl who covers her walls with strange and beautiful drawings and then gets sucked into their very scary worlds.
So these shadows, where do they come from?
The Darklands. Over there.
Mirror Mask is a fairy tale, and Anansi Boys deals with all kinds of magical events, but they're also pretty compelling pictures of the world circa 2005. Here with me now in Studio 360 is their writer, Neil Gaiman. Welcome.
Thank you, Kurt.
Mirror Mask, I think, is your first feature film?
It's the first feature film I'd written to get made.
And tell us what it's about. What happens?
It's about a young lady named Helena Campbell. She's about 15, and she's part of a small family circus. It's the Campbell Family Circus. And at the beginning of the film, she gets into a blazing row with her mother.
Helena!
Okay, I'm getting dressed! There is no need to shout at me!
I am not shouting!
It's one of these horrible teenage girl-mother arguments. And at one point, her mother tells her that, you know, all the kids in there, they'd love to run away and join the circus. And Helena says, well, let them. I want to run away and join real life.
I don't think you could handle real life, Helena.
Real life, you can handle real life. So can.
And she gets her wish much quicker than she bargained for when her mother falls very ill and the circus is off the road. And she winds up having a very strange dream one night. And it's a dream, or is it, in which she does get to inhabit a world that's comprised of the things that she's drawn and the things that she's imagined.
I'm glad you said, or is it, because there is not that Wizard of Oz moment where it was all just a dream at the end.
No, there isn't. And I felt fairly strongly about that. I like the idea of just scumming the borders a little bit. It may or may not have been a dream, but whether it was a dream or whether it was simply her working out, whether she was working everything out internally or whether there were actually more to that going on, it's up to the viewer to make their own mind up.
There is a good queen under a spell and an evil queen and a lost child, all of which are pretty venerable basic materials. I wondered what your sources for this film and this screenplay were.
I don't think it was so much the kind of thing that had specific sources as a matter of Dave McKean, who directed it and who I came up with the story with, and I needing to know what kind of thing we were doing. We had the best and simplest brief I've ever had going into this, which was the Jim Henson Company saying, could we do a family fantasy movie, kind of like Labyrinth or The Dark Crystal or one of those kind of things, and could we do it for $4 million? And that was the brief, and it was very simple. All we had to do was come up with something like that and make it on something that would barely cater a Hollywood film. It was funny. Once Dave McKean shot it, and then he went out to get his animators, and his animators who worked under him were basically half of the graduating class from, I think it was, Southampton College of Art. And he showed them the rough cut of the movie with all the blue screen.
Which is just actors doing their thing in front of literally giant blue screen.
Literally a studio painted blue. And at the end, the animators, these young kids, this wasn't just their first film, it was their first job. And one of them put up his hand and he said, how many special effects are there in this? And Dave said, well, only one, but it lasts 80 minutes.
As the parent of a couple of girls around Helena's age, I found the whole film very truthful emotionally. And I wonder if your experiences as a parent informed the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I love being a parent. I think being a parent is possibly the coolest thing you ever get. And I been very lucky in having three amazing kids. And even then, I got to watch my oldest daughter figuring out who she was and sort of rehearsing things and her relationship with growing up and getting old. I remember when she was about 14, she saw The Craft and came home one day. And all of a sudden, she was this beautiful goth thing. And I went on for a few days, and then I went over and I said, you know, you probably don't want to be a goth. And she said, why not? Do you want to stifle my self-expression? And I said, oh, no. I'm perfectly happy for you to be a goth. It's just that if you are a goth, then sooner or later you'll be down in a cellar with your goth friends listening to goth music, and they'll be going, our parents don't understand us. And you'll say, my parents don't understand me. And they'll say, oh, talking to your parents, can we have your dad's autograph? I said, so it really won't be any fun to be a goth. It's great. She has dreadlocks now and a doubly pierced nose. So, and I don't think I reacted anywhere near as horrifiedly to either of these things as I should have done.
And speaking of girls and children and Henson, Jim Henson's daughter, Lisa, was the executive producer of the film. What was it like working with the Henson Company and Jim Henson's progeny?
Well, it was wonderful. It was great. I mean, Lisa was the one who began the whole thing. She phoned me up. She said, we have $4 million. We want to do a fantasy movie. She said, I know I've seen some of those films that Dave McKean had made. He made a couple of short films literally in his mother's barn, literally for nothing. And she said, and they look amazing. They looked like Mirror Mask. And she said, could he do that? And I said, I don't know, but I'll ask him. The next thing I knew, Dave McKean and I were in the Henson family house in Hampstead, which actually hadn't been touched or done up or anything since Jim died. You felt like Jim Henson was just literally around the corner. You walk into the laundry room and there's a couple of old Muppets of goats and things just lying there, rotting away. I put one on my hand and discovered that I could close its eyes if I squeezed a little bulb. So I squeezed a little bulb and this goat's eyes slowly closed. And then the eyelid, which was made of very old latex by this point, just rotted and gave way. And it was the most disturbing thing I've ever had on my hand, I think.
Disturbing, but it sounds like a perfect, serendipitously perfect circumstance.
It was definitely part of the thing. It was a wonderful place to be making this thing, and a wonderful place, you know, I went downstairs and wrote down there in the kitchen because it was warm, and Dave was a few floors up where there was a grand piano, and he'd play the piano, and we weren't sure whether Mirror Mask was working until Terry Gilliam came over for lunch one day. And he looked at this big sheet of paper we'd been mapping the movie out on and just sort of said, you know, he was saying, I used to come over here all the time when Jim was alive. We'd just come over and hang out. And he looked at the paper and he said, hey, that looks like a movie. And suddenly Dave and I stopped worrying. It was like, okay, Terry Gilliam says it looks like a movie. It's a movie. Let's just get on with making it.
You used to be a movie critic.
I did, for my sins.
Do you put on your old film critic hat as you're writing screenplays and bring that kind of critical eye to the thing?
I don't think I do. Partly because I was a terrible film critic. I wasn't a proper cineast film critic. I was just somebody who was a young journalist in London, and lots of my friends were real film critics, so they would go along to all these film screenings. And I discovered you could go and see films 2 or 3 months before they came out and be given a glass of white wine and some chicken, which seemed a good and not pay for anything, and not, you know, lovely comfy seats. So I go along. And then because I was turning up at the film screenings, people would say, oh, you were there. Can you do us a review of so-and-so? And suddenly I found myself with 2 or 3 film columns and having to adopt different pseudonyms for different magazines. And I did it for 2 or 3 years and then stopped. And then it took me 3 years to go back to the movies. I'd seen a movie a night for 3 years and was very happy not to. But I think, if anything, the sensibility that I tend to bring to screenwriting is to try and avoid that sense that I used to hate of knowing minute for minute exactly where in the film you are. That sense that some Hollywood films, beat for beat, had become almost as ritualized as Japanese no theater. and that, okay, now we're at that point where everything looks good, but actually it can't be good because we're only 62 minutes into the film, so therefore, oh, there we are, minute 64, everything's fallen apart. Now everything has to get worse. Yes, minute 67, it's got really bad. Okay, so now at minute 71, we have to come, you know, and you sort of, you know, my deep loathing for that, just as a way of plotting.
Well, and particularly given the material you tend to, the universes you tend to occupy, right? Because anything can happen in your books.
Yes, but anything, but that's always a very strange double-edged sword, the idea that anything can happen, because it's like that moment where Roger Rabbit pulls his hand out from the handcuff, and Bob Hoskins says, "You could have done that at any time." And he says, "No, only when it was funny." In writing a novel or a comic or even a film with fantastic elements, you can't do anything. You can only do what the story will let you do, and you can only do what feels right in the story.
And you need to set up your own rules and then play by them.
You have to set up your own rules and play by them, even if you don't explain them. The reader has to know that they are in more or less safe hands, even if those safe hands may do dangerous things sometime. They need to trust you as a storyteller and to know that you won't just simply make stuff up, even if you're making everything up. So it's the wonderful paradox of fantasy of writing fantastic fiction.
Neil Gaiman is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Coming up, we take a peek into a dysfunctional family of gods. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the African duo Amadou and Mariam, who blend the sound and rhythms of their homeland with Western pop on their new album Dimanche à Bamako, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I am talking today with Neil Gaiman, author of legendary comics and best-selling novels and movies, and the subject of Tori Amos songs. "Get me Neil on the line," she sings. You and your books, as it turns out, show up in about a half a dozen of Tori Amos's songs. How has that happened?
I don't really know how it began, other than because it began before I knew her. I mean, these days we're very close friends, and we've been friends for a long time. But the first I knew about it was in 1991, and I was signing people's comics in a line at the San Diego Comic Convention, and somebody in the line handed me a cassette tape, because they used to have cassette tapes back then. And he said, "It's a friend of mine. She's made some music. She sings about you on one of the songs. Please don't sue her." And it was, you know, I was given maybe four or five cassettes at that convention. And I put on the first cassette in the car, and it was turned out to be some sort of Scandinavian gothic rock of a guy accompanying himself on the harmonium.
That sounds more like the sorts of tapes that you would get.
Well, I just remember it was all sort of, "Oh, Lord Morpheus, come down from the sky and bring your sister Death." And I, you know, so that was that on that song, and then I put the Tory thing in, and it was wonderful. She'd sung this song about, you know, if you need me, me and Neil will be hanging out with the Dream King. Neil said hi, by the way. And I thought it was so cool that somebody, most people noticed Sandman, but didn't even notice that somebody really was writing it. And she had just gone, okay, yes, this is Neil. And we've been fast friends ever since.
And now you have to write her into a book, I guess. Or
I did. I've written her in a couple of times. The best one was in a fairy story I did called Stardust, where I showed her some drawings from it before it was written. And she said, will you make me a tree in it? So I made her into a tree. And so if you read Stardust, there's a tree in that who's based on Tori Amos.
I'll look back. You've said that American Gods, which was your novel of 4 years ago, was your book coming to terms with America. And I wondered what you mean by that.
I'm English.
Really?
I am, yes. They don't believe the accent is still English back in England, but at least out here people do. And being English, I'd come out to live in America. I had a very specific idea of America based on the fact that I'd been out here quite a bit. I'd you know, done conventions and signings and book tours. And more than that, I'd watched American television. I'd read American novels. I'd watched American movies. England's practically a satellite in some ways of America in terms of culture. And I came out expecting one thing. And I was living out near Minneapolis, where I still am, and started to realize that there was an America that I was seeing and experiencing that wasn't something that I'd expected. And part of that, I think, was just the equivalent of, you know, if you're coming into something from outside, you're seeing things that people who do live there naturally wouldn't necessarily ever write about. But, you know, I'm out there in the Midwest experiencing these winters at a sort of the kind of cold that I'd only previously imagined in science fiction films, where your world shrinks to what you can heat, watching people do things like park cars out on the ice of a lake and run bets for charity on when the ice would melt enough that the car would fall in. And again, this is kind of weird and odd. And I decided I wanted to write about that. I wanted to write about, as essentially an immigrant, I wanted to write about the immigrant experience. And it seemed like gods were the perfect metaphor, the idea that they were these things that people brought over with them culturally and then abandoned. And I found a wonderful quote from a folklorist named Richard Dawson. And he just commented on the fact that people didn't bring their fairies with them. The Greeks or the Norwegians talking about magic would talk about it back in Norway or back in Greece, but as something that didn't happen here, that they just didn't cross the ocean.
And you start American Gods with a quote from that book.
So I start with that quote, and that was really where it began for me. And the idea just of using gods as a way of talking about culture and forgotten bits of culture and the assimilation and the American dream. And I got to play with it in all sorts of different ways.
It's interesting that this book came out in 2001, just on the verge of this sense of our God and their God and various people's gods telling them to do very different things in this clash of civilizations. Were you aware at the time you were writing it of having real world resonance of that kind?
No, but it definitely began to resonate and to resonate hard. You know, it's very peculiar looking back on it. I did a book signing tour, much like the one that starts for Anansi Boys tomorrow, 4 years ago, and the first signing I did was in the Borders Books in the World Trade Center. And I started off in the World Trade Center, signed in that Borders, went off on a book signing tour all over America, England, Canada, came home, and then it was September the 11th. And it was odd. It didn't feel like, you know, it had rendered the book redundant. It actually felt like it was talking about the same kind of things.
In American Gods, you introduce, in a small way, Anansi. He's now back in a huge way in Anansi Boys. Who is Anansi?
Anansi is originally a West African god, and then he sort of dwindled a little bit. What tends to happen is things start as religion, and then they become mythology, and then they become fairy stories. You know, the sacred and holy things begin, and then it becomes, they accrete stories to themselves, and then sooner or later, you know, the Cupid and Psyche has become Beauty and the Beast, and you're amusing kids with them. And Anansi, the spider god, had all these wonderful stories in Africa, and then went to the Caribbean, and they spread out. But Anansi is a trickster, and he's very clever. He's full of himself. He's either a spider or a man, depending on how the story is being told. And he was always just one of these characters I've been very fond of. And I put him in American Gods. I actually borrowed him from a book I hadn't written yet. So it was more like he got to guest star from Anansi Boys, but I knew that I wasn't going to get to that for a while.
Really? But you already had the whole thing in mind.
I had Anansi
Boys. You're like George Lucas or something.
Oh, I don't. Please, no. I had Anansi Boys in mind, and I knew that he died on pretty much the very first page. So I liked the idea of actually getting this character on stage so that you could meet him before he died. But it's a bit odd now because everybody now expects Anansi Boys to be a sequel to American Gods. And American Gods was a very big, very serious, you know, 600-page book with moral weight, and it won all these awards. And
but occasional humorous, more than occasional humorous asides.
I hope so.
This is
but it's not a funny, but it's not intentionally a funny book, nor is it in any way a comedy. Whereas Anansi Boys, although it does share one character, is very intentionally a comedy. In essentially the Shakespearean sense of everybody getting what they need at the end.
Let's listen to a little bit of the Anansi Boys.
All stories are Anansi stories, even this one. Olden days, all the animals wanted to have stories named after them. Back in the days when the songs that sung the world were still being sung, back when they were still singing the sky and the rainbow and the ocean. It was in those days when animals were people, as well as animals, that Anansi the spider tricked all of them, especially Tiger, because he wanted all the stories named after him. Stories are like spiders, with all their long legs, and stories are like spider webs, which man gets himself all tangled up in, but which look so pretty when you see them under a leaf in the morning dew and in the elegant way that they connect to one another, each to each. What's that? You want to know if Anansi looked like a spider? Sure he did, except when he looked like a man. No, he never changed his shape. It's just a matter of how you tell the story. That's all.
Sounds like Anansi may also be the god of writers, I guess.
You know, if you're writing a story, there's always a level on which it becomes about the nature of story. At least there is for me. But the point in Anansi Boys is that we get, I hope, three very different types of people, all of whom relate to each other in the ways that families do. You have Fat Charlie, who is very sweet, very nice, and is...
like everyone.
He's all of us. And, you know, it's that thing one does where you stand up suddenly on a plane and bang your head straight into the overhead thing and then bags fall down on your head and everybody looks at you. And that sort of, you know, Fat Charlie moment. And then there's Spider, who's his brother, who is the essence of cool and is about as cool as you can possibly be, if not cooler. And then there's his dad, who is embarrassing. And that's really every dad. I mean, it's my theory about families that I have no idea about the sort of the, you know, all happy families are the same, but unhappy families are unhappy in their own way. That may or may not be true. But I do know that all families are embarrassing in different ways, and that everybody assumes that everybody else's family isn't embarrassing.
In Anansi Boys, as in American Gods, there is so much obvious knowledge of folklore and mythology. Did you come to these books already being a kind of mythology geek, or did you do tremendous amounts of research?
A little of both, but mostly the lovely thing about being somebody who loves mythology is you can get to spend a lifetime absorbing bits of it from everywhere. You know, when I was 7, my favorite books, probably apart from C.S. Lewis's Narnia books, were Roger Lancelin Green's Tales of the Norsemen and his Tales of Ancient Egypt. I love this stuff. Ate it up. It was wonderful stuff. With Anansi, I got to... it was actually kind of fun. When I started the book, I went looking on the internet for Anansi stories. and found one site that reprinted a few stories from a book published in about 1919 from somebody who'd actually gone over to Jamaica and interviewed people. But really, you know it all already. And also, in the case of this book, I got to make some of it up, which was really fun. You know, the idea of a place with totem animals in it felt right, and it needed to be there for the story to work. But it's not actually from any mythology. It's just something I made up to make the story work.
I'm glad you told me that, because I would have gone to some cocktail party with a mythology scholar and talked about the end of the world where all these totemic animals live, and I would have been thought an idiot, I guess.
Oh, probably not. I mean, the scary thing is, you know, every now and then I'll make stuff up. And
turns out to be true?
Well, actually, sometimes it turns out to be true, and sometimes you just find it being taught in colleges where nobody's bothered to check.
There's a point in Anansi Boys, I don't know, maybe a quarter of the way or a third of the way through, where I stopped and said to myself, these characters are all black. These are all... because you never actually say, he's a black guy, this is a black person, which is kind of remarkable. Again, a thing I've never seen in a contemporary novel. And it also it suggests that the world is as happily colorblind as this book seems to portray it.
I think part of it may come out of the fact that I spent many years writing for comics in which you can see everybody. And doing work in prose for me is there's something of going, okay, what can I do in prose that I couldn't do in comics? What can I do in prose that I couldn't do in movies? And I realize one of the things that I can do in prose is have you quite comfortably be some way into the book before you notice the skin color of the various characters. And I'm very, very good about pointing out white characters whenever they come on, or at least letting you know hair and skin color. You know, they all get pointed
to. The main villain, for instance.
Yep. And, you know, some of the good characters. But it was really fun.
Were you
building a story in which you are going to have to figure out all that stuff for yourself?
Well, it was very fun. That part of it was very fun to experience, too. And as you suggest, was a new trick for me as a reader to experience in reading this. Do you still write comics?
From time to time, yes. I did a couple of years ago. I wrote an incredibly fun, for me, I don't know about for the readers, comic called 1602. Which came out from Marvel and is up for a Quills Award, this new award that rewards things that have sold lots of copies anyway and don't really need awards.
And what's interesting about your comics and the Sandman series, your comics are that they are not these twee little small circulation graphic novels. They are comics.
Yeah, although they get collected into graphic novel form and sell lots of my big circulation graphic novels. It's so funny, the whole graphic novel term. A story I've told before, but it is true and deserves probably repeating in this context. It was about 1990, maybe 91, and I was in England at a literary party. I mean, it was something like the Daily Telegraph Christmas party. And I got talking to somebody who turned out to be the literary editor of the Sunday Telegraph, one of these big respectable broadsheets in England. And he said, so what do you do, young man? And I said, well, I write comics. And he looked as if I'd thrust a herring at him or something, you know, recoiled, but there was nobody else to talk to. So he said, what kind of comics do you write then? And I said, well, I do a thing called Sandman. I did a book called Violent Cases. I'm just done a thing called Signal to Noise, which has been serialized in The Face. He said, hang on, you're Neil Gaiman. And I said, yes, I am. He said, my dear fellow, you don't write comics. You write graphic novels. And I honestly felt like a hooker who'd just been told she was actually a lady of the evening. I was like, oh, okay, if it makes you feel more comfortable. I loved writing comics. As far as I'm concerned, it's, you know, comics is an odd sort of word, but it's about as relevant. It's a catch-all title, but it's as relevant as calling films movies.
Right.
I mean, it's not, yes, movies is a term that dates back to the fact the novelty was these images were moving. I'm going to the movies.
And there are good ones and bad ones and serious ones and French ones and American ones and all different kinds.
Exactly.
And they're all called movies.
Except
for the films.
And I'm sure that you can have a completely static one and it would still be called a movie.
It seems to me just lately, the last few years, with you and your work and the success of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which I know you thought very highly of, and the work of the Japanese filmmaker Miyazaki, that fantasy, if those can define a certain part of it, no longer has the can't-get-no-respect problem. It seems to me you're becoming entirely respectable.
I think that's true. I'm not convinced it's necessarily an entirely good thing. I've always loved the gutter. And I loved the gutter when I was writing comics, and I kind of love the gutter. And
it's the rock and roll in you, I guess?
Maybe, and maybe it's just the it's so much more fun feeling like you're doing stuff when nobody's looking. It's so much more fun doing stuff where, honestly, it doesn't matter what reviewers say. It doesn't matter if they know, you know, they probably, you wouldn't get reviewed anyway, so you don't, genuinely don't care. And you're just off there trying to do cool, different, weird things. You know, I keep going off and doing nice, guttery things, and then they get all respectable on me. And I definitely don't do them in a bid for respectability. I do them because they're really fun.
But will you really, quite seriously, go for the unrespectable just to keep your hand in the gutter?
Yeah, I might do. I mean, I'm quite serious. There is a certain amount of fun to doing stuff where nobody expects anything.
So that Pamela Anderson project could be a Neil Gaiman.
Absolutely.
I understand that you read a lot of poetry.
I do. I love poetry.
Has that habit fed into any of your writing?
I think the poetry read into definitely fed into the comics.
I would think.
And in fact, I think I learned so much about what some of the things that you can do using words and pictures and captions from some of the more concrete poets. Because poetry is all about economy and it's all about reducing things down. And because you're tying words in and you're pushing how much freight you can actually give words. I remember using, particularly in Sandman, sometimes in Black Orchid, just going for poetic rhythms. You'd do things like write an entire page in iambic pentameter, knowing that nobody would ever notice, but that on some cheerful, down deep level, the fact that you were setting something in an Elizabethan period and doing it all in iambics would resonate. Plus, the great thing about comics, which I miss when I'm doing novels, I really miss in prose, is knowing that I can pretty much guarantee that everybody will read every word. I can pace everything. Every caption, every line of dialogue.
Right, they're not going to skip over, like, boring-looking.
You're not going to get to that point where you hit a paragraph which looks like it's going to be dull and your eye slides down to the next piece of dialogue. And there may have been some really cool and important stuff in that paragraph that you slid over. Whereas in Sandman, I can guarantee you read pretty much every word and read them at the pace that I wanted them read and turned the page at the moment I wanted that page turned.
So it is, in that sense, it is like a film on paper, essentially. I mean, that nobody misses a line of dialogue in a movie.
Exactly, unless they've nipped out for popcorn.
If part of your desire is to keep people guessing and not get too respectable, certainly if you wrote a straight piece of classic, serious, realist fiction, that would shock everyone these days. Is that something you might do?
If ever I came up with a story which demanded it. I mean, the last time I actually did a piece of serious, realist fiction was actually about 14 years ago when I did a graphic novel called Signal to Noise, which was about a film director who was dying of cancer making his last movie in his head. We absolutely had to be in a world in which everything was utterly real and in which, you know, you've got cancer, you have declined to be treated, and you are now on a ticking clock to death, and meanwhile you are making art, and this is what's happening. If I came up with an idea for my next novel or next adult novel that by its nature could have no fantastical elements,
you'd do that.
Then I'd do that. It's not that I sit down going, okay, I'm going to come up with a fantasy. It's more just that whatever part of my head provides stories. If stick me out in the woods in front of some little pool with a small hunter's cottage or whatever in front of it. And if you took me out and Stephen King and John Grisham out and you pointed us at this thing, Grisham's going to come up with an idea about some guy fleeing, a lawyer fleeing the mob who's going to hide out in this place while everything's going on. And Steve King might think about the thing that comes up out of the lake and devours everybody in the cottage. And for me, I might just think about, the little house getting up on chicken legs and walking away. When I was a kid, just a little kid, I remember one of those things that adults always say to you. They say, you're making things up. And they'd say, don't make things up. And they'd say, you know what happens if you make things up. And I really didn't. And I, these days, of course, I do. It involves lots and lots of international travel and not having to get up too early.
Neil Gaiman, it has been a pleasure talking to you today.
It's been wonderful.
Neil Gaiman's new novel is Anansi Boys, a couple of 100,000 copies of which are making their way to store shelves as we speak. And his new movie, Mirror Mask, has just been released. You can find out more about him and his books and his movie at our website, studio360.org. Coming up, 50,000 pounds of energy in the palm of a child's hand.
I'm a super ball.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is brought to you in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring the African duo Amadou and Mariam, who blend the sound and rhythms of their homeland with Western pop on their new album Dimanche à Bamako, available at tower.com/nonesuch.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. We often ask listeners to tell us about experiences with some work of art that changed their lives. Armando Bajolo wrote us from Washington, D.C. and gave us two for the price of one. When he was a little kid, he was swept away by a Hollywood soundtrack, and then when he got older, by the music of a more esoteric composer.
I was born actually in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and was raised there till I was about 16 years old, then came to this country 16 years ago this summer. And I got into classical by way actually of Star Wars, believe it or not, and out of that soundtrack, that John Williams soundtrack. I hadn't heard an orchestra before, and it just was, wow, this is really kind of cool. Even listening to the soundtrack at home, I could tell who was who by what I was listening to. Well, the dark, kind of gloomy music, oh, that's Darth Vader, you know, and then the heroic stuff, oh, that's Luke, and he's doing this, and I loved it. I still love it. Only later I found out, oh, but he's using leitmotifs. He's doing the same thing that Wagner did. I really credit John Williams' Star Wars soundtrack for planting that seed when I was about 4 or 5 years old that led me to pursue piano and then actually just start composing and compose the kind of music that I went on to compose. ¶¶ I had a teacher. Her name was Susan Hurley. And I'll never forget this. She asked me, well, because at the time I was typical, I was rebellious against new music. And I thought, oh, 20th century music is so ugly. And, you know, I wanted to write this music that sounded like Mozart, like Beethoven. And she took me to a side in one lesson. She said, you know, you write what you want to write, but think about this. Do you want people to listen to your stuff when you're gone? And they hear it and they say, oh, that sounds like Mozart. Or do you want them to say, that sounds like Bajolo? It sounds like Armando Bajolo. Just having that challenge to be open-minded just really opened my ears to what was out there and what was possible. And I came back with a string quartet that was completely different than anything I had done. And something clicked. I'm in this process, my first year at the University of Michigan, you know, thinking, well, who do I want to write music for? What kind of music do I want to write? Well, let me hear some things that I'm not as familiar with. And I thought, well, I know this Andreessen piece. I've met him. I kind of like what I heard. Let me see what we have in the library. And I pulled out a few things, but I pulled out the Materie first. I thought, well, okay, here's a big piece. I like big pieces. So the piece starts with the huge, very defiant chords, which in a way, actually, that's what grabbed me the most. But hearing it the way Andreessen does it in the Materie was just so different. I mean, it's just the same chord 137 or 147 times, because it's a duet for two hammers. And so literally they're just banging away rhythms. It just distills everything to just rhythm. And it also uses vocal soloists in a small group of about eight singers as a little choir. In the first movement, they sing about Dutch independence, and that they sing the Dutch Declaration of Independence from the Spanish. And then they also sing about shipbuilding, which is what made them, you know, what helped them become independent. My biggest piece, this oratorio, has Materie in its mind. And, you know, this, it's a 72-minute piece for a small chorus, a small ensemble. And it's a setting of a passion, of the passion, but not setting the Bible, setting poetry. But that piece wouldn't exist, or at least not in the shape that it's in right now, were it not for Materie. And I wouldn't have done things like having solos for percussion with hammers representing nailing people up to a cross if I hadn't heard Materie Part 1 with, you know, long hammer duet. But this is pre-Mel Gibson, by the way. There's this sense, I think, in American music, and this is why I don't feel like I'm courageous enough to do it in my own music. I think there's a cultural thing. We want things to move quickly. You know, we have fast food, we have remote controls, 500 channels of TV, and we sit and flip channels constantly. Everything is fast, fast, fast in our culture. You know, the first 3 minutes of Materie are the same chord, just gradually sped up. It can be hard to take. But if you stick with it, the payoff is incredible. And I think it's perhaps the greatest piece written in the last 25 years.
Armando Bajolo's Oratorio will premiere in Portugal in December. Studio 360's David Krasnow produced our story. If there's a symphony or a book or play or movie that changed your life sometime, we'd like to hear about it. You can reach us through our website, studio360.org. In science, a lot of the time, unlike in art, invention isn't just about discovering something new, it's about making something useful. And that can be difficult. Consider the chemist Norman Stingley. He invented Zectron, a compound that could contain 50,000 pounds of energy in a little sphere the size of a walnut. It sounds amazing, but in the end, all it was good for was fun. Today in Design for the Real World, Paola Antonelli, design curator at the Museum of Modern Art, explains the art and science of the Super Ball.
The Super Ball truly is so much fun. When you're a child, you tend to play with it in your mom's home, and that's bad because there's always some porcelains around or the window, but it's so irresistible. There's nothing more fun than just to bounce it against the walls and then against the ceiling. I mean, it really is so much fun to see how this object can behave. Really interesting how it was born, because once again, often engineers are at the beginning of great stories. And in the early 1960s, he invented a material called Zectron that bounced uncontrollably. And so he decided to make it into a real ball and called it the Super Ball.
I'm a super ball. You can bounce me once and I ricochet.
Then, of course, he found this company in California that was already known for manufacturing fun objects. And that was called the Wham-O Company. The toy was a sensation. The public bought it in thousands and hundreds of thousands, so much so that copies started coming on the market that were much cheaper, not as good, and after a while, Wham-O decided to take it out of the market. There was a revolution. There were riots around the United States, and they received so much pressure from the fans that they had to put it back in the market. And at that point, a few years had gone by, and there was a new type of Zectron available that could be compressed at 50,000 pounds of pressure, so even more resistant and even more bouncing. The recovery bounce is approximately 90%, which means that if you throw it from the 10th floor, it bounces back to the 9th floor. So in one celebrated incident, actually, a giant Super Ball produced as a promotional item was accidentally dropped out of a 23rd floor hotel window in Australia. And it shot back up 15 floors, then down again onto a parked convertible.
You can bounce me once and I
really, it bounces back. There must be a Super Ball paradise or heaven where all the Super Balls that we've lost go. You know, it's because we lose them, because they bounce around and we don't know where they go. So I'm sure there's some place in the world where there's like a corner in the world that's full of Super Balls.
Paola Antonelli is design curator at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I watch hardly any broadcast TV these days. The Simpsons and the PBS NewsHour I both see with some regularity, but otherwise, aside from the odd late-night talk show or episode of 24 or West Wing, that's really about it. We're now in the middle of the new fall TV season, but I certainly don't make a point of seeing new series the way I did when I was a kid. But the other day, I happened to catch one new sitcom on NBC. From its magazine and newspaper ads, the show had looked like it might be in the Beverly Hillbillies, Dukes of Hazzard tradition. In other words, a stupidly coarse, high-concept show about working-class white rustics.
You know that guy you see going into the convenience store when you stop off in that little town on the way to Grandma's house? Sort of shifty-looking fella who buys a pack of smokes, a couple lotto scratchers, and a tall boy at 10 in the morning? The kind of guy you wait to come out before you and your family go in.
But the new show amazed me.
Well, that guy is me. My name is Earl.
My name is Earl is flabbergasting because the premiere episode, anyway, was a brilliantly coarse, high-concept show about stereotypical working-class white rustics.
Hey!
I got you, Earl. You're it. You're it!
That's Sonny. We play beer can tag.
Ain't no use running, fool. I know where your mama parks your house.
Sitting at home alone watching a new network sitcom, I chuckled. More than once. Out loud. That hasn't happened to me in years. The premise, a young redneck guy has an epiphany that makes him apologize for all his life's many major misdeeds. Well, that should have led to a stupid, unwatchable show. Instead, it's genuinely witty in its raunchy, broad fashion and completely original, as well as charming. Bizarre. My name is Earl makes actually funny jokes about race when Earl's scheming, slutty wife cuckolds him with a black friend. It makes funny jokes about hookers.
Patty wasn't your run-of-the-mill prostitute. She was a daytime hooker. Takes a special kind of woman to sell sexual favors in the light of day.
As well as about really stupid people and the handicapped and gay people and about homophobia.
I don't have a man because nobody knows I'm gay. You know what this town is like, Earl. I mean, besides, even if people knew, where am I going to meet anyone?
Well, what about the city? Don't they have special bars for the queers? I'm sorry. Homosexual Americans?
My Name is Earl is a show, in other words, that is genuinely, and for a network, staggeringly, un-PC. But the hero and the show also, in their improbable, skeevy way, have a worldview that's compassionate and progressive. It's about real redemption, even as it makes fun of all-American instant redemption. It's sentimental in a way that somehow manages not to sell out its satire.
Look, my whole life, I've been scared to be who I really am because of what people might think. But then Earl Hickey brought me to a gay bar. Earl Hickey went to Express for Men and bought me a shirt. Earl Hickey, the one man I was the most scared of in my whole life, has accepted me as I am.
Now, plenty of people, particularly a certain kind of intelligent, refined, solemn person who, well, probably listens to a lot of public radio, will not like this show. But the rest of us, maybe intelligent, but not so refined or solemn, are eager to laugh like we did at All in the Family 35 years ago.
I won't have that lotto money, Earl.
Yeah, well, I wanted a legitimate baby and a wife who didn't huff paint on Thanksgiving. But I guess life's full of little disappointments now, ain't it?
Laugh sometimes with pleasantly shocked little gasps. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you've been listening to Studio 360, and I really hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Arun Roth,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Amol Mathre,
Caitlin Lindsay,
Will Becton.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
Now then, Dimitri, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dimitri.
The cultural influence of the bomb.
The hydrogen bomb.
From Dr. Strangelove to the war in Iraq. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI.